Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 405, side one. The title of the broadcast is Fifth Column. This is being recorded on March 31st of the year 2003. The more recent For the Record programs are streaming on Real Audio, www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, DaveEmory. A detailed annotated description of For the Record program number 405 will be in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. And we're going to go directly to a program, or to an article, I should say, titled The Wahhabi Trojan Horse in the U.S. Military. It's by Robert G. Willis-Croft, and it's about chaplains in the United States military. It's about some of the milieu that was involved with the March 20th, 2002 Operation Green Quest raids. And it is about a grenade attack, a fatal grenade attack by a Muslim paratrooper over in Kuwait. And what this article deals with is, it's called A Trojan Horse here, but it deals with some of the Islamo-fascist links to some very significant and generally speaking, respected Muslim institutions in the United States. And it talks about one of the dangers of what is basically a fifth column within a potential fifth column within the United States military. Now, by extension, I'm going to deal with the links between this milieu and the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th of 2002. That is discussed here in this particular article. This is basically a national. Military community, I think, would be a better way of putting it. Website, it's called sftt.org, subtitled Soldiers for the Truth. The organization is called Defense Watch, and this is called The Voice of the Grunt, or subtitled, I should say. The publication is dubbed The Voice of the Grunt. There is an article, and the website, by the way, is www.sftt.org. The full URL will be in the annotated For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. The article here deals with a Wahhabi-slash-Islamo-fascist underground Reich fifth column, although it does not deal with it in terms of the underground Reich. It does mention Al-Taqwa. It does mention Ahmed Huber. It does not mention all of the connections here, and this is in no way to, or that obtained to that milieu, including the links to the Republican Party. We're going to talk about those, the links through the Sami al-Aryan lawsuit. We're going to talk about those directly to George Bush and to the Republican Party. A very interesting connection indeed. Another aspect of this, and I want people to consider what I'm presenting in this broadcast to represent something of an overlap between Sun Tzu, Machiavelli, and On War by Karl von Clausewitz. Also, imagine something like a cross between the German invasion of France in World War II, the Battle of Verdun in World War I, and something called Operation Bernhardt. This was a Third Reich slash SS slash Gestapo forging operation in which expert forgeries of pound notes were printed in Nazi concentration camps. And this was an attempt, and it came a lot closer than some might be inclined to believe, to actually destroying the World War II British economy by basically flooding the international currency markets with false pound notes, thereby leading to a tremendous devaluation of the pound and a destruction of the British military-industrial manufacturing process. This article is by Robert G. Willis-Croft. It's called The Wahhabi Trojan Horse in the U.S. Military. And what the author begins with is a description of the function of chaplains in the military. The chaplain corps within the U.S. military performs a vital function. Young men and women preparing themselves for battle face something that most young people never think twice about: death. Imminent death. A majority of Americans are religious, men and women of faith. Consequently, a majority of our fighting men and women are also people of faith. The chaplain assigned to a given unit serves as the focal point for the faith needs of the men and women in that unit. Most believing Americans are Christian in one form or another, but America has a significant subculture, a small but growing Muslim population, and members of several other faiths, including Buddhist, Baha'i, Hindu, Sikh, and Hindu and Sikh, among others. Currently, the largest Muslim segment is black, rising out of the black Muslim movement of the 1960s, but we also have a significant Bosnian element and a growing Muslim population originating in the Arab world, which in general terms includes all the Middle East except for Israel and North Africa. From a logistics perspective, within the chaplain corps, it is not possible for the services to place a chaplain of each faith group in every unit. Instead, chaplains learn to minister to every faith, at least in the sense that they can meet the immediate needs of men and women preparing for battle. When a young military man or woman faces another kind of problem outside of the immediate military situation, then the local chaplain can call in one of his colleagues from the appropriate faith to deal with that specific situation. In this sense, chaplains work closely together to serve their combined flocks. All chaplains have at least a 4-year college degree, some type of formal training within their specific faiths, and some level of experience ministering to congregations. Within the military community, each service determines how the available chaplain billets are allocated among the different faiths. Normally, the allocation is between Christian, including all the various denominations, Jewish, Buddhist, and Muslim, according to some formula. Within the individual religious faiths and their denominations, each determines its own qualifications for a chaplaincy. Depending on the structure and nature of a specific faith, an appointment may be formalized through a certification board or as informal as through an individual application by a practicing minister. Because the people coordinating chaplain admissions in all the services typically have a Christian background with a growing Jewish representation, they tend not to be very knowledgeable about the other faiths. It is natural, therefore, that they should turn to the organizations that are knowledgeable to qualify chaplains from these faiths. And here this gets into a very, very interesting situation, not only about the legitimate side of many very influential Muslim institutions in this country, both nonprofits and businesses, but also the problem of the difference between genuine religious doctrine and something that is therefore protected by constitutional rights and things that are basically related to terrorism. And one of the things that some of the Islamo-fascist organizations in turn linked to the underground Reich seek to do is to use democratic and constitutional civil libertarian traditions in the West in order to basically turn those around and use them as a weapon of war. This in turn creates friction within the civilian community. And so as you listen to the discussion here of the issue of the training of, or the general foundational training, one might say, of Muslim chaplains for the United States military, the fact that these overlap Islamo-fascist institutions, very powerful institutions, institutions connected to the underground Reich, institutions which are in the foreground, I guess one could say, center stage in the drama surrounding the March 20th, 2002 Operation Green Quest raids. You're going to hear some familiar names, some powerful names, some perhaps not so familiar names, but the milieu being focused on here is the milieu of the 3/20/2002 raids, overlapping not only the business and political milieu of George Bush, but also that of Islamo-fascist elements connected to Hamas and the 9/11 attacks. And as is the case within the American elite, where venerable institutions, or venerable names, I should say, such as the Bush family and the Walker families, very, very venerable American names, names like the Rockefellers, Mellons, DuPonts, and others, were involved to one degree or another, in the Bush case of the Bushes, a very large degree, with Third Reich finance and also with the deadly and remarkable post-war Bormann organization. So again, consider What I'm about to discuss here, courtesy of Mr. Williscroft, once again, the author is Robert G. Williscroft, capital W-I-L-L-I-S-C-R-O-F-T. an apology there. As we listen to what Mr. Willisconoff has to say here, what we're basically going to be examining is the milieu of March 20th, 2002. And bear in mind that Talal Altman, a director of Harkin Energy, political and business ally of George Bush, is intimately connected to this milieu, and he interceded on behalf of these interests with then-Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill. And Paul O'Neill, subsequently after this particular intercession, bowed out and bowed out quickly. Continuing here, in early 2002, the U.S. Air Force asked the Islamic Society of North America, or ISNA, for assistance in recruiting Muslim chaplains. On July 20th, 2002, the ISNA announced that, quote, it is recognized by the Department of Defense as an endorser of chaplains, unquote. As of July 22, 2002, ISNA has vetted all 13 of the Muslim clerics serving in the U.S. military. Since then, it has endorsed four more. Since 13 Muslim chaplains were active before the involvement of ISNA, it is reasonable to assume that their endorsement by ISNA was pro forma. This cannot be assumed about the following four, however. Why should this matter? The ISNA has been in the forefront of American Islam. It has represented itself as the voice of moderation in the war of words surrounding Islamic terrorism. This is probably why the Air Force considered the ISNA an appropriate source for vetting information. My research has uncovered the additional fact that the ISNA relies upon the Graduate School of Islamic and Social Sciences, or GSISS, for its actual vetting information. The GSISS also had developed a reputation for moderation, so even this further connection appears on the surface to be reasonable. By the way, more about this and among other programs, 356, 357, and 386, as well as program 398. Continuing, a major player in all these interactions is Dr. Jamal Barzinji, the director of GSISS and board member of GSISS and a related moderate organization, the International Institute of Islamic Thought, or IIIT. He is a well-known, articulate spokesman for moderate Islamic interests in America. Not so well-known is that in 1980, he was a representative of the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, or WAMY, which was deeply involved in providing cover for Wahhabi Muslim extremists. The Wahhabi branch of Sunni Islam is the radical branch which is home to Osama bin Laden. In 2002, the president of the WAMY office in Annandale, Virginia, was Abdullah bin Laden, Osama bin Laden's younger brother. Just 1 year ago, on March 20th, 2002, a U.S. Treasury task force called Operation Green Quest raided an interrelated group of Islami Wahhabic interests in northern Virginia. Among these were the Herndon, Virginia offices of Dr. Barzinji and the SAR Foundation, created by wealthy Saudi Suleiman Abdul al-Raziz al-Raji. By the way, Jamal Barzinji, directly connected to the al-Taqwa milieu, and also a member of the board of directors of the Islamic Institute. So, by the way, was the aforementioned Talal Altman, Bush business associate. Continuing here. The SAR Foundation is connected to a former, speaking here, let me repeat the last sentence just for the purposes of continuity. Just 1 year ago, on March 20th of 2002, a U.S. Treasury task force called Operation Green Quest raided an interrelated group of Islamic Wahhabi interests in northern Virginia. Among these were the Herndon, Virginia offices of Dr. Barzinji and the SAR Foundation, created by wealthy Saudi Suleiman Abdul al-Aziz al-Raji. The SAR Foundation is connected to a former Swiss shell company, al-Taqwa, whose leading figures included a notorious neo-Nazi and Islamist, Ahmed Huber. The term Islamist refers to Wahhabi-inspired international Islam that is both fundamentalist and terrorist-oriented. Al-Taqwa had transferred operations to the United States, but was shut down after September 11th when its assets were frozen by U.S. presidential order. But operations continued as the Wahhabi lobby shifted to its backup institutions in northern Virginia. Operation Green Quest linked SAR to Khalid bin Mahfouz, the former head of the National Commercial Bank of Saudi Arabia, and lead financial advisor to the Saudi royal family. Mahfouz was named by French intelligence as a backer of Osama bin Laden in that he endowed the Muwafaq Foundation, which U.S. authorities have confirmed as part of al-Qaeda. Furthermore, Muwafaq's former chief Yassin al-Qadi oversaw the financial penetration of Bosnia-Herzegovina and Albania by Wahhabi Muslim extremists in the late 1990s. To put things into perspective, in 1998, SAR received $1.7 billion in donations. Dr. Barzinji is a trustee and officer of Amana Mutual Funds in Bellingham, Washington. Yaqub Mirza is a fellow board member. By the way, the aforementioned Talat Atman was as well. He, again, close associate of the Bushes. Speaking of Dr. Barzinji, and by the way, note that Bellingham, Washington is one of the places where the accused sniper John Muhammad was hanging out without apparent means of support and living relatively well for someone who was homeless. One wonders whether this African-American Muslim with a military background and with a history that would suggest that perhaps he was receiving aid from the Green Quest milieu, is discussed in, among other programs, FTR 386. Dr. Barzinji is a trustee and officer of Amana Mutual Funds Trust in Bellingham, Washington. Yaqub Mirza is a fellow board member. He is a Pakistani physicist and financial guru who shares Dr. Barzinji's Herndon, Virginia office. Samir Salah is another Amana board member and Herndon associate. He ran the Caribbean branch of Alpaqua. He also heads a financial firm linked to SAR and directs the Falls Church Virginia Mosque, Dar al-Hijra, which is a Wahhabi hotbed. Salah is also deeply involved with the Virginia charity Taiba International Aid Association, which has a Bosnian branch that is under investigation by Sarajevo authorities. All of these interrelated individuals and groups matter within the context of this article because they show up behind the benign facade of the two organizations that are responsible for credentialing any Muslim cleric who becomes a U.S. military chaplain. Let's pass by that once again. Evidence unearthed in the past year strongly suggests that Wahhabi Muslim extremists indirectly control the vetting procedure for all Muslim chaplains in the U.S. military. The implications for this are staggering. On March 22, 2003, an American Muslim soldier rolled grenades into the tents of the entire command structure of the 101st Airborne Division's 1st Brigade Command Group at Camp Pennsylvania in Kuwait. One man was killed, and 11 were seriously injured. At this time, it is not known whether or not he was under orders from an Islamist cleric. What we have in place, however, is a mechanism that practically guarantees that this will happen with increasing frequency. We already know that a properly motivated Muslim terrorist will willingly kill himself in order to take out an important target. Military chaplains have the ability to influence personnel assignments. With proper manipulation, several sleeper chaplains can arrange for a significant number of undercover terrorists to be prepositioned so they can cause maximum damage to our command structure. CENTCOM Commander General Tommy Franks is a regular guy who openly moves among his troops when he is in theater. How difficult would it be for a determined undercover terrorist functioning as a soldier or a marine nearby to assassinate him in a suicide attack? I have no evidence that any of the 17 Muslim chaplains currently serving in the U.S. military are anything but honorable clerics serving their country during time of war. Nevertheless, the potential problem is very real and imminent. This is a wake-up call. We must address this potential problem forthwith to ensure that no terrorists have slipped into the ranks of our brave men and women in harm's way in Iraq or anywhere else in our military. To do any less would be criminally negligent. This again from the Defense Watch website, site at sftt.org, and that in turn by Robert G. Willis-Croft, who is a Defense Watch senior editor. He can be reached at dwnavyeditor@rge.net, or rg.net, A-R-G-E-E.net. And what that article is talking about is obviously the potential for an Islamo-fascist slash Wahhabi slash Muslim Brotherhood fifth column within elements of the U.S. military because of the related interests, control over the vetting procedure for chaplains in the U.S. military and for the functional operations that those chaplains actually perform within the context of the military infrastructure. What we're going to look at now concerns the relationship between war and economics, and I guess one could subtitle this broadcast, among other things, Pecunia Nervis Belli, Money is the Sinew of War. And what we're going to look at now is the overlap, or we're going to take a look at the expenditures, obviously, that are being taken for war, or the issue of expenditures that are being taken for war, at the same time that there are interests headed up by Grover Norquist, who also has very strong connections to the milieu of the Operation Green Quest raids. He's the co-founder of the Islamic Institute. Grover Norquist has been leading the Bush administration's push to slash revenues, slash taxes on the very wealthy. Slashing revenues at the same time as increasing expenditures for war is a very, very bad business indeed. And looming behind some of the aspects of not only the Anglo-Saxonia versus Germania scenario that I've been presenting, but also the issue of the dollar versus the euro, consider the following. This is from the Financial Times of Friday, March 21st of 2003. It's by John Plender. It's headlined, "The Sinews of War Are Asian," and it reads in part, "The 19th-century British political economist Walter Bagehot, B-A-G-E-H-O-T, had a pithy quote from Louis XIV on war finance. 'The last guinea,' said the Sun King, 'will always win.' In this case of Iraq, it will be the last U.S. dollar, and one of the more remarkable things about the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq is just how easily and cheaply the venture will be financed. On the face of it, war has rarely been waged in such inauspicious financial circumstances. At a time of extreme geopolitical uncertainty, the payments balances of the world's biggest economies are badly out of kilter. U.S. household savings are seriously depleted, and the deficit on the current account of the American balance of payments is close to an unprecedented 5% gross domestic product. The U.S. has, since the bursting of the stock market bubble, become a relatively unattractive destination for foreign private capital. Interest rates are low, the dollar is weak, and the U.S. economy will advance this year at less than its underlying trend growth rate. Yet as private capital has fought increasingly shy of the world's economy, the central bankers have come to George W. Bush's rescue. Japan, China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Singapore alone have accumulated official reserves worth more than $1,100,000,000, of which the great majority is invested in dollar-denominated IOUs such as U.S. Treasuries. For many central banks, these reserves are earning much less in interest than they could earn back home. This is not, of course, a philanthropic gesture for Japan. With a stagnant economy, it is a matter of resisting an appreciation of the yen that would hit the export sector. The others maintain a dollar peg, largely for reasons of competitiveness." And skipping down, speaking of the fact that the relatively cheerful U.S. economy may very well decline, and that may come as the fact that it is relatively cheerful may come as a surprise, well, it may get worse. The article concludes, "Yet it remains the case that global finance has been exceptionally kind to Mr. Bush, and Louis XIV was indeed expressing an age-old verity. The Tacitus version was, 'Pecunia nervus belli,' money is the sinew of war. We should not forget that unlimited money, however helpful, cannot guarantee the peace." And what we're going to be looking at during the second half of the program concerns Grover Norquist, who again represents something of a link between the Operation Green Quest milieu that can be found within, at one level, the vetted chaplains for the United States military, and also, by the way, as we looked at in For the Record 398, prison chaplains, African-American prison chaplains as well. We're going to be taking a look at Grover Norquist's attempts at basically lowering the economic status of the United States through tax cuts. Note the following in terms of the struggle between the euro and the dollar that I've expressed in many programs such as of FTR 401. This also is from the Financial Times. This one is from the Financial Times of Tuesday, March 25th of 2003. This is by Paul Betts and Martin Arnold in Paris. The owners of Airbus, the pan-European aircraft maker, are seeking to persuade their main U.S. aerospace rival, Boeing, to adopt the euro as the benchmark currency for the traditionally dollar-based commercial aircraft market. By the way, this article headline, Europeans try to pull Boeing into euro. Subtitled, attempt to change base currency of aircraft industry reflects shift of power. Note this, because one of the things that is just screwing the U.S. air industry, in addition to September 11th, also the war in Iraq. Again, this article, Europeans try to pull Boeing into euro. Subtitled, attempt to change base currency of aircraft industry reflects shift of power. The owners of Airbus, the pan-European aircraft maker, are seeking to persuade their main U.S. aerospace rival, Boeing, to adopt the euro as the benchmark currency for the traditionally dollar-based commercial aircraft market. The call from Philippe Camus, co-chief executive of the Franco-German European Aeronautic Defense and Space Company, EADS, reflects the cost disadvantage that Airbus currently suffers following the sustained depreciation of the dollar against the euro. Quote, currencies are a factor of competition, and we want to force Boeing to adopt our currency structure, unquote, said Mr. Camus in his first interview since the death earlier this month of Jean-Luc Lagardère, the EADS co-chairman. However, Mr. Camus' call also has a symbolic edge, reflecting the recent change in the balance of power in the civil aircraft market. Airbus, of which EADS owns 80% and BAE Systems of the UK 20%, last year claimed 54% of new orders for large aircraft by units and dollar value, with Boeing taking the rest. Airbus started offering euro-priced aircraft when the single currency was launched in 1999, but demand has been limited as the used aircraft market remains entirely dollar-denominated. Financiers have up until now been reluctant to lend against assets with such a currency with such a currency risk present. And it goes on, the article that is, goes on to say, Mr. Camus said Airbus was fully provisioned for U.S. dollar fluctuations this year in 2004, but coverage incrementally decreased after that. One of the things that's interesting here is obviously the fact the influence of September 11th, and in terms of examining Grover Norquist, in terms of examining what, for lack of a better term, could be called the Flying Dutchman, Arne Krutoff and Rudy Dekkers, two Dutch nationals who run flying schools in Venice and Naples, Florida, the only two, and these just happen to be the schools at which the September 11th pilots, many of them anyway, trained, and in turn the connections go back to children of the German elite. One last article, this also from the Financial Times. Thursday, March 27th of 2003, note again the influence of September 11th and the Iraq War on the airline industry. Look at who is benefiting. Look at the role of the dollar and the euro. Also consider the following, this again from the Financial Times, this of Thursday, March 27th of 2003. Article by Jennifer Hughes in London, headlined, Fate of the Dollar Remains Tied to the Fortunes of War. Skipping down, there has been much talk about the war premium on the dollar, and analysts at Crédit Agricole Indosuez calculate a war premium between 4 and 5% is still priced into the dollar, but represent a significant drop from a near 10% peak. The lower the casualties, the more limited the length of the war, and any retaliation, the better for the dollar, or so the thinking goes. Strategists widely predict a sharp relief rally when the conflict is considered to have ended. So this again indicating the relationship between combat, the infrastructure of the September 11th and Operation Green Quest raids, its links to the Bush administration, the Republican Party, its role in basically weakening the United States economically. Again, pecunio nervus belli. And we're going to continue with this in the second side of the program. Bear in mind that at WFMU.org/Dave Emery, the For the Record programs are streaming on Real Audio. More recent programs are. And at a longer URL, they're available for download only. Older shows, that is. Spitfirelist.com, equipped with Real Audio. Look in the For the Record section for an article-length, detailed, annotated description of this program within a week or so of the airing of the program. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 405. Fifth column, being recorded on March 31st of the year 2003.